Okay, well, let's see what the plan is. Anyway, okay.
There's two of them, and they say the exact same spot both times, but I'm sorry, like I say that.
Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please.
All right, Lisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, "What the hell is that?" Midway across the Hudson River was a perfectly circular disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, it's good to be in your ears again. The major UFO story since we last connected has been the Stephenville, Texas flap, which has received an enormous amount of media coverage around the world. And I spent many days trying to get someone from the Texas chapter of MUFON to join us and fill in some of the details. To no avail. James Fox was in Erath County, Texas, to cover the case for his next documentary, and I managed to connect briefly with James just before he set off for the Channel Islands to interview Ray Bowyer, the commercial pilot who sighted the enormous object over the English Channel. James suggested that he might be back in time for this edition of SDI, but I haven't been able to reach him. So, to give us some behind-the-scenes info, which hasn't been covered by the mass media, Don Ledger, former pilot, will join us to fill us in on some of the facts surrounding Stephenville. And pretty incredible stuff it is, too, as will Dave Ferlot and former military chopper pilot Alfred Lemberg. And rounding out the lineup for this edition of SDI is Michael J. Woods. Mike and I were invited by David Cherniak to preview his documentary, UFOs and the Politics of Reality, the making of which this program has given extensive coverage to over the past couple of years. And to put it mildly, Mike and I enjoyed that documentary.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Ferlock.
A small little city in Texas seems to have all kinds of people in a confuzzle. People supposedly getting fired for doing their job, people claiming to be put under pressure to shut up about what they saw, and even the U.S. Air Force confused about where their planes are at any given time. It all began back on January the 8th, 2008, when a large object was seen moving across the sky with a myriad of flashing lights. The witnesses to the event number over 30, and some of them recall seeing fighter jets chasing the craft across the sky, which the Air Force originally denied by saying they had no aircraft in the area. And people must have gotten confused by seeing two passenger jets and their lights. Oh, and let's not forget the Air Force added to that statement by volunteering that they no longer investigate UFOs. Why bother investigating them when you already know what they are? Oops, did I say that out loud? Oh, me bad. The thing is, the whole affair stinks to high heaven, because there are so many different things going on. Groups that should be on this story like Ugly on an Ape are doing their very best to suppress things at the moment. My guess is that perhaps the smell of money is strong in the winds around Stephenville, Texas, population around 15,000. Oops, there I go thinking out loud again. What I do find amusing about the Stephenville incident is the Air Force pulling the same thing that the Army Air Force did way back in 1947, making a pretty bold statement one day, and then not very long after that, correcting themselves by saying something else. In this case, the Air Force was quite clear by stating they had no aircraft in the area on January the 8th, and then after the story hits air and with no sign of stopping it, they go, actually, we might have had something in the air that night. We had a flight of 10 F-16s up there on a training mission. Yeah, that's it. A training mission. Really? A training mission. When so many witnesses have stated that the F-16s were chasing this thing, one can only conclude the Air Force trains their fighter pilots on how to chase UFOs. Wait a second. Why would you chase something you don't investigate? Better yet, why bother chasing something you concluded back in 1969 was no danger to national security? See what I mean about everybody getting confuzzled? Oh, there's one other little problem, too, with the number of aircraft in the air. Flights of modern jets now follow the two or four aircraft flying formation. We don't see big flights of aircraft flying in formation anymore. So to have 10 F-16s in the air flying together in some kind of training mission would be a pretty substantial thing, and kind of difficult to forget about. I don't know about anybody else, but it kind of concerns me when a military force as powerful as the U.S. Air Force can misplace 10 fighter jets and not realize they were in the air when they should have been on the ground. Now, according to things that are starting to come out, a reporter breaking the story and subsequently getting a lot of media attention drawn to the area got fired from her job. Although, from what I can conclude in my investigation of that, for various unknown reasons, Angelina Joyner submitted her two-week notice to leave her paper. And she was then told to pack up her desk and leave right away. Either way, the Stephenville UFO caused a significant career move for the lady. Others are claiming they've been threatened to keep quiet, and one or two have even reported having warning visits by officials. Now, I can see that there will be a lot of problems over time with this sighting because of the large amount of publicity it is receiving. I can almost guarantee that the ranks of people who originally saw the craft will at the very least double as everyone tries for their 15 seconds of fame. So batten down the hatches. Prepare to do a lot of serious digging if we really want to get at the facts behind Stephenville. However, that doesn't mean hold back on what you already know to be fact by stalling people that are involved in the ufological community either. The community as a whole needs to be basically kept informed, and we need to get information that is as fresh as possible so we can actually really put it under the microscope. It needs to be not sanitized and carefully packaged information, because in that situation, that's about as good as the nutritional value found in some fast food. The wrapper will be better for you than the contents. Yeah. Stephenville, Texas definitely has a lot of people confuzzled, including myself. And I think confusion will reign there for a long, long time to come. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Perlant, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Yeah, Stephenville certainly is a very strange situation, Dave Perlant.
It's crazy.
Well, it all started, as you said, back on the 8th of January at around 6:15, and then it continued on to 4:30 the next morning, which is kind of interesting.
We're not talking there's something nice, and 5 minutes later it's gone.
So there were the Stephenville sightings, same day, there were sightings also in San Antonio, in Victoria, and in Corpus Christi in Texas.
Everybody is sort of going, excuse me, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force is sending up the F-16s, and they're going, oh, no, 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 we don't have anything up there. No, no.
No.
No, nothing at all.
That whole Air Force thing is really bizarre, but as Don Ledger pointed out on the UFO updates list, Stephenville is very close to the Bush Ranch.
Yeah, that's exactly why they would vector up something. Somebody would be sending out all kinds of messages to that little thing and going, tell us who you are, you know, turn on your...
Ping, ping, ping.
Yeah, let's know who you are. And getting no response, oh yeah, they're going to vector stuff up there real fast.
And that airspace is the most tightly controlled airspace, if not on the planet, certainly in North America.
Oh yeah,
over
for
the
sure.
Bush Ranch. Obviously, there was nothing up there in training.
No, no, not at all.
Because it's the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. So the right hand says, no, there was nothing up there. We had nothing up there. There was nothing training. Then all these witnesses, and it's now close to a couple of hundred witnesses altogether, come forward and say, well, we saw F-16s chasing this object.
If you've seen the picture of an F-16, there is no mistaking that aircraft. Yeah, okay, that's an F-16. And last time I checked, the U.S. Air Force marks them pretty accurately.
Well, there was a civilian pilot who saw everything that went down there. And he says, first of all, he couldn't figure out what the object was. It was a series of lights that seemed to be in a boomerang shape. Where have we heard that before?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the infamous boomerang.
And he was on the ground. And those lights maintained a steady distance one from the other, so we can rule out flares.
Oh, yeah.
We can rule out it being anything that was built down here, because they certainly ain't going to fly anything that was built down here and maybe a black project in the general direction of the Bush Ranch.
No.
No.
No, they're not going to do that. That would be very, very silly.
The Mutual UFO Network, both the national organization and the state organization, had a zoo interviewing witnesses on January the 18th in Dublin in Texas. And they had a huge number of people show up there. They had given a lot of advance publicity. And, of course, the tinfoil hat-wearing people were there. The media was there en masse. I know James Fox was there. And that was a zoo, but a lot of reports came out of that in addition to the 8th, 9th of January in Stephenville, a lot of old reports from people who said, well, when we first saw them years ago, we were really reluctant to come out and report them officially because we didn't want to be laughed at.
Exactly. It's a double-edged sword, though, when they do that kind of publicity, because in some situations it pulls out the people who actually saw something.
Mm-hmm.
But in the other situation, it pulls out the crackpots. They're going to say anything.
Another interesting result of this was that, of course, Larry King Live covered it off again.
Oh, of course.
The second time he dedicated an hour to UFOs in about, what, 5-6 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And some interesting people on there, including James Fox, who was there. But also note the lack of presence of Magahahaha. And the substitution in the skeptic corner, Michael Shermer.
Yes.
I guess the skeptic organization, CSI or PsyCop or whatever the hell they call themselves now, were somewhat embarrassed by McGay Hayes' appearance on Larry King Live.
Well, he did kind of nicely drop the ball quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Hence, Magahaha.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Now we're sitting waiting for March, when MUFON will officially release their report on the Stephenville incident. And don't think, listeners, that we haven't tried to get a hold of any of the MUFON Texas people and get them to come on this program and talk about some of the stuff that's been going on down there. There is this wall of silence, other than, of course, coast to coast. Forget the podcasters. They don't count anymore.
Yeah, they're just cutting us down, saying, nope.
The director of MUFON, Texas, has forbidden any of the investigators to talk to the media.
That one is interesting.
Well, apparently there is more information to come out that will amaze and astound us. And on the subject, and you brought her up, Angelia.
Yes.
The newspaper reporter down there for the Stephenville Herald. One of the reasons they apparently hastened her departure, and I don't know how true this is, but this is from a reliable source, was that she submitted her notice when she was told that they weren't going to be covering the UFO story anymore.
Yeah.
She was frustrated by that. She gave them until February the 14th, at which point they turned around and said, okay, hand over the laptop that you've been using because it's ours, and thank you very much, and as of right now, bye-bye.
Yeah, exactly. It was like,
but
here's your hat, watch your hurry.
From the reliable source, I hear that she had been assigned to cover off one story and decided that she wouldn't cover that. She would go and cover a story to which she wasn't invited, whatever that means. A little cryptic.
Mm-hmm.
But that was apparently the reason for them saying, okay, you have to go now.
Some of the stuff that's coming out as well is implying that perhaps some pressure was put onto the Herald as well. Whether or not that's fact or fiction.
Yeah, well, that could have come from any number of directions, too. That could have come from the military. It could have come from someone who doesn't want them talking about UFOs, advertisers, or any of the, right in Bible Belt country down there.
Oh, yeah.
Don't want to be talking about no UFOs in our local newspaper. Them there's devils and demons.
We'll burn in the pits of Hades.
Pits of hail. Yeah.
There's a lot of confusion on this one. A lot of people scratching their heads. And
yes.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the official report.
Well, official as it can be out of MUFON.
Yeah.
Or
well,
MUFON, as a lot of people like to call it, as in UFOs.
Good point.
So if we say MUFON, then that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Otherwise, MUFON. You get idiot media people calling it UFOlogy.
Yes.
Yeah. Mike Woods and I are going to be talking about David Cherniak's documentary, which is just astounding. We had a pleasure of taking a look at that. Woodsy and I agreed, definitely the best UFO documentary we've ever seen. And that's coming up next on this edition of Strange Days Indeed. Dave Verlot, thank you, sir.
Thank you. It's been fun.
It has, hasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, let's hope it's as much fun when the actual Stephenville report comes out. We'll see.
Oh.
We'll cover it.
Oh,
we shall
yeah.
do it. But real hard putting together a program if you can't interview any of the people who were down there investigating. Thank you, guys. Next time, Dave.
Next time, Dale.
Off we go into the wild blue yonder, climbing high into the sun. Here they come, soaking to meet our thunder. And the boys, give her the gun.
A big, long area of bright, bright, intensely bright lights.
The lights are, the navigation lights are what I saw.
They were extremely bright.
In a line, in a straight line, and so long.
What was so odd, these lights were flashing like a strobe.
A strobe that just kept going and going and going.
I have a drawing that I made.
Other lights would start doing stuff.
It had kind of a flat bottom on it. It was round, kind of gumdrop shape.
It would look like, kind of like a light show.
They were not disrobing, they were moving around.
It was like an energy field of some sort going through the center of it.
In an instant, they were gone.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed. I've got everything I need. I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I can fly. I'm a supersonic guy.
A few days ago, Michael J. Woods, a regular contributor to this program, our space correspondent, and a former host on Strange Days Indeed, and myself, had the good fortune to be invited to David Cherniak's house here in Toronto. David Cherniak is an award-winning filmmaker, and we got to go to his basement edit suite studio and see his current project, almost finished, except for some audio tweaks and some color tweaks. UFOs and the Politics of Reality. On the line with me is Michael J. Woods. Was that not an amazing documentary, Mike Woods?
Absolutely the best one I've ever seen on the subject, Harold.
Me too.
Well written, well told, and with one hell of a conclusion.
And it's a conclusion that David Jacobs in the past has come to on this program, mm-hmm. as has Katarina Wilson in the last SDI.
Yeah, and ever the more frightening for it, becoming ubiquitous.
And it left you somewhat shooken up?
Yeah, it's perhaps the most uncomfortable fact within the entire field of UFOs when you look right at it, as far as I'm concerned. It should be the biggest area of concern overall, and I hope that was sufficiently oblique enough for anyone. Overall, let's face it, that was an excellent documentary.
Of course, I feel that way, too. David Cherniak is an old friend now, a man who, as I said in the introduction to Mike, is an award winner in many areas, and a couple of Geminis here in Canada for his work with CBC and the Man Alive series, which, interestingly enough, David Cherniak was the producer of that series, and that series brought David Jacobs, Bud Hopkins, and several abductees to Ontario to spend a weekend at a cottage. Many years ago, David Cherniak was the very first producer to cover abductions.
This film shows all the signs of a very sophisticated filmmaker.
Yeah,
I like the multi-layeredness of it. You look at the event, then you look at the evidence, then you look at the government response. You look at an event, you look at the evidence, you look at the response. I enjoyed that aspect of it. A real ground floor primer, and yet a very revealing look at what has happened to the whole UFO phenomenon over the years.
That was commissioned by the History Channel here in Canada. Unfortunately, it's probably not going to air on History Canada until September, which means it'll be a little while before it actually gets out there.
Yeah, sometime in the fall. Mm. I imagine during the fall sweeps when everyone's looking for ratings, that one's going to pop up.
Oh, yes.
And deservedly so.
And I know a lot of people who were involved in this field when civilians ask them, what's all this UFO stuff about, pull DVDs out and say, here, take a look at this. And I think UFOs and the Politics of Reality is going to be the DVD discs that will be pulled out by UFO people for many years to come.
To give you an idea of exactly how clear and insightful it is, I believe that ES laid out so mm-hmm. cleanly and so simply, even a politician would be able to understand it. You know?
And the participants in the documentary will be, I'm sure, thrilled to pieces with the way David Cherniak has put it together.
Absolutely. To quote an esteemed colleague of mine, you, the graphics that are shown throughout it are tasty. Everything about it is tastefully done, but with a sense of humor. And with a sense of humor directed at the skeptics who like to spend so much time laughing at others. Well, this time it's directed at them.
Yeah.
It was certainly one of the better 2 hours I've spent recently.
Apparently there's a hell of a lot more material left that will go on other DVDs and will be put out there as a box set eventually. So quite looking forward to that, too.
Yes, well, let's hope for that for Christmas presents. What?
That'd be very nice.
I shall hoist that up to the top of my list.
And the participants in the documentary,
they will be well pleased with how they appear and how they're quoted.
As you said, I said, the computer graphics, the animations were very tasty. Probably the best I've seen ever in a UFO documentary. It is wonderful.
Yeah, this is one where it all feels right. The facts are right. The presentation is right. It doesn't have that overhyped, shrill feeling that some UFO documentaries have that keep humping you over the head. You will believe, you will believe, you will believe. Just really well done.
And before we embarrass David Cherniak too much, maybe we should stop reviewing his documentary, UFOs and the Politics of Reality.
The only way it could have been better was with two bags of popcorn, I think. Now, we will mention, by the way, that if you happen to have excess capital in your pants and you need to go and buy a DVD, around this time, I believe In the Shadow of the Moon is out. That's a documentary with interviews with the still-living astronauts who have walked on the moon. They're in the next week or so, In the Shadow of the Moon. From the moon, then, let's wander out a little further and say happy birthday, as both Spirit and Opportunity have now spent 4 years operational on Mars on a three-month mission.
I'm blown away every time you come on and remind us that they are way past their 90-day warranty.
Warranty. It was a 90-day mission back in October of 2007. NASA extended the mission for a fifth time through 2009, as long as the rovers continue to cooperate. And they're hunkered down for the winter, still operational, still hanging in there 4 years after they first landed for a 90-day mission.
I like the little man on the moon, too.
Oh, yes.
For those of you who are wondering what we're talking about, well, go read UFO updates. What we talk about on this program is covered in text form. The image that one of the rovers sent back, the Mars Man.
Oh, yes.
It's amazing how glib some of the NASA scientists are in dismissing. It's a weird rock formation.
It's amazing how easy it is to dismiss them as such. I mean, let's face it, you and I both know it probably is just a rock formation.
Yeah.
However, never a sign of hesitancy there. You'd think they would be a little more circumspect considering their past history for, you know, mistaking kilometers for miles and attaching the wrong leads on a rocket engine. Mm. Oh, let's leave this electrical wire here against this cryonic tank. Oh, that makes sense.
Kaboom.
Oh, boy. Well, Errol, on that note, I think I'll let you go.
Well, thank you, Michael. Always good talking with you. Let's once again thank David Cherniak.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. I was exceptionally flattered to be invited to see it. You never know. I've gone to some film previews where you were reduced to that most polite of phrases, that was interesting. Very interesting.
Oh, a different point of view.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly. A wonderful perspective. Whereas with this one, boy, it was hard not to babble like a goof. That's really well done. Go on.
Mantell's plane looked real, for God's sake.
Well, every one of the damn plane sequences,
yeah.
I was like, oh, what is that?
Oh, Dakota. Wow, it is a Dakota. Look at that. Mm-hmm. It's not a cartoon.
Do you know what? I thought that was probably the best representation of the Kenneth Arnold sighting I've ever seen.
Yes, it was brilliant. It
okay.
was brilliant.
That
the pelicans.
Really gave you a feeling for what he observed,
mm-hmm.
you know, at
yes.
the type of ranges and the speed, the rocket-based pelicans.
Mike Woods, thank you, sir, as always.
You're more than welcome, sir.
And we shall talk real soon.
Okay.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Jets following the lights right over the top of my house, and it shook my house.
I could clearly see that they were jets. I could clearly hear that they were jets.
They weren't training when we saw them, and especially that late at night. I'm not trying to say they're lying or anything, but they've lied once.
It somewhat tarnished their credibility.
I think there's other stuff out there. If it's getting close to the end like everybody says it is, and maybe they're coming back here to see the same thing we're waiting for.
This didn't just happen. It has a cause, okay? You know, for years, you know, all the time I was in the military, they've always wanted to have some kind of a hovering device that was silent and it was also big.
Either some type of new weapon or new craft or something that they're working on.
Dave Perlot and I talked earlier on about Stephenville and what's been going on down there, the January 8th, 9th sighting of an enormous object in the skies over Stephenville, Texas. We also mentioned the fact that Don Ledger had pointed out on the UFO updates list that the Bush Ranch is real close to Stephenville and might have explained why the jets were up in the air. But we can get into that with our East Coast correspondent and the Canadian NARCAP representative. Out to the East Coast we go, and on the line with us is Don Ledger. Hello, Don.
Hello, Errol. How are you today?
Oh, pretty good.
Sunny weather down here for a change.
Oh, lucky you. It's winter in Toronto, and winter the way we used to have winters 20, 30 years ago when I first arrived in Canada. So Stephenville, I guess, has been pretty intriguing for you, too.
You know, it sort of tipped me off. It was interesting what was going on, and then it just kept going on and on and on, and then it was showing up on Larry King, and then it showed up on Larry King again, and it was in the papers all over the place. So eventually you start paying attention. But on one of the other lists, Joel Carpenter, a pilot, I don't think he's been flying for many, many years now, and a private pilot like myself. And he, since we had gotten into this yes or no about F-16s being in the area, whether they were there or not, naturally, we all know now that the military did an about face and then admitted they not only had two, but they had 10 down there doing an exercise in the military operational area, what they call an MOA, which, as it turns out, was probably not the case. Anyway, he sent a map, well, a scan of the air charts. It's called the SAC in the United States, which is a sectional aviation chart. And up here we call them VNC charts, but they're essentially the same thing, same scale, and they even join together. This particular one showed the area of Dallas-Fort Worth Airfield, and then just southwest of it slightly, this Stephenville. He also included a round circular white area in there, enclosed by what's called D-class airspace, or at least the blue dashes that surround a D-class airspace that's shown on these air charts. And it was totally whited out in there, except for saying he had an inner circle that said Bush Ranch on it. And I had no idea up until that time that the Bush Ranch was so close to this sighting. So that sort of twigged my interest, and I mentioned it to him. But nobody else seemed to go with that. But it made sense to me that now there was a good reason for them to be waffling on whether there was aircraft in the air or not that night. And F-16s, as Steve Allen claimed, he saw two of them in afterburners chasing either the same object or another object as it was in coming back from the west to the east, just south of them.
Steve Allen is the pilot,
but
he was on the ground, a civil aviation pilot, who was one of the witnesses to this enormous object.
He's a 30-year pilot. He's flown a twin Cessna for some years. He just sold that recently, and just keep his hand in, bought himself a little Cessna 150 to poke around in. He's very familiar with what's going on in the sky, as a lot of us are. We get used to looking at the sky. The thing of it is, Steve was not only by himself, but he was with his lifelong friends, and as he called it, Primer, when he went to school. His name is Mike Odom, O-D-O-M, and another friend of theirs, less acquainted, but still a friend, Lance Jones. It was after work, and this was the first night they'd had where the temperatures were warmer. You know, they've been getting hammered with some cold weather down there, too, in Texas. And the three of them were on a little knoll about 3 miles east-southeast. It's almost dead on an east line out of Stephenville, just outside of Selden, Texas. And they had a little campfire going. They were sitting around just enjoying the oncoming night. Steve told me that the sun was just going down. He had maybe about a half a disc or a little less. And when one of them tapped him on the shoulder and said, "What the heck is that?" You know, and he looked to the east and saw these lights coming towards him. They were moving at quite a clip. Probably most people have seen the description he had, where the lights seemed to be spaced about a mile long and a half mile high. They were big, round, brilliant lights. But to him, they looked like they were on a fixed object. But when they got closer, he couldn't see anything in between them. They were either very good at formation flying, or there was something invisible between them. He makes no bones about that. He doesn't claim to have seen a solid object. He assumes that this was a solid object. He just couldn't see it. Now, many, many years ago, you might say, well, I don't know. It probably wasn't solid. But there's been so many weird descriptions of unidentified flying objects over the years that you tend to think, maybe the thing was invisible. I don't know. I don't even buy into it myself. But, I mean, you know, there's still that possibility there. But if they're going to be invisible, why show lights? Anyway, this thing flew over top. It was coming from the east, flew towards Stephenville. The light configuration changed when it got over that way, and then it disappeared. Now, he assumed this thing was moving at this time at about 3,000 miles an hour. That's really clipping. Everything went right still, he said. And I've heard of this before, particularly where these large objects are concerned. Of course, we all know there was dozens of sightings in Stephenville and in Dublin and the little surrounding area. In the meantime, Lance Jones was so disturbed by what he saw, he decided he was going to go home. It upset him. Steve hadn't mentioned earlier, I don't think, was the fact that it upset him, too. It didn't upset him the way it upset Lance Jones. But he said, I was disturbed by it. He said, I was thinking at the time, if this is the beginning of some kind of a War of the Worlds thing, he said, I think I should be home with my family. They dropped by to drop Mike Odom off at his place, and he went in with Mike for a few minutes, and Mike told his wife about what had happened and that Lance had been disturbed by this thing and tore off home. So she apparently knew Lance's wife, so she called over there to see how Lance was doing. And he picked up the phone as soon as he heard where it was. He said, it's coming back. I can see it now. It's coming back from over Stephenville. Hmm. So they all ran out. So there's three of them now again, Mike Odom's wife, Mike Odom, and Steve Allen. If it was the same object coming back, it was slightly south of the road going from Stephenville down past Selden and heading off to this east-southeast, almost along the east line. At this time, he said it was moving at maybe about 600 miles an hour, and its speed was increasing, and right behind was two F-16s coming up behind it. They had their afterburners on. That's important to note.
Yeah.
Because a short time afterwards, he got a call from another pilot friend of his who lived down in Hicko, which is along that same line, but slightly north of Crawford. Now, we're going to get into the other restricted thing in a minute here, but I just want to set up the lines, saying that he and another pilot were sitting around out in their back enjoying the night air when they heard two sonic booms. Sonic booms and afterburners kicking in. It can sound similar, but a sonic boom is normally more impressive. Now, the afterburners were already on if they were the same F-16, so they were probably pushing themselves over the sound barrier at this point, which is illegal. All right, you can't do that unless you have permission from your commanding officer or whoever controlling you at the time, because sonic booms over populated areas, and this is a populated area, is verboten. It's assumed then that these two F-16s had gone through the sound barrier at this point, somewhere down around Hicko, which is about maybe 15 miles east of where Mike Odom and his wife and Steve Allen were. The thing of it is if you draw a line from the center of Stephenville over to what's called the restricted zone around Bush's Ranch, there's an outer circle and an inner circle. The inner circle is 60 nautical miles wide, which is about 69 miles in diameter. So you take half of that from Bush's Ranch out to the west, you would have 34 and a half miles distance. From the center of Bush's Ranch out to the inner perimeter is 6 nautical miles, or about 7 miles, 3.5 miles, in other words. That's always restricted. You just can't fly over that period.
And does that apply to the military as well?
Yeah, nobody can. It's covered by the Secret Service, and then after that, the FBI and the military and so on. The Secret Service gives permission to everybody if they're going to be in that zone, and it's normally restricted to police helicopters, rescue helicopters, and, of course, military, and their own helicopters. The Secret Service have on their own. They have their own pilots and helicopters and so on. And, of course, that's how Bush gets in and out of his ranch, right? Yeah, it is a Marine helicopter, yeah. This odor ring that extends outwards is not always in effect prohibited, but it can be changed at a moment's notice. It could, you know, 1 hour could be unprotected airspace, supposedly, and there's still limitations there, but it could quickly change over to protected in a matter of an hour. And what that would mean, there would be notables going out to the airfields, particularly Dallas-Fort Worth, and any other controlled airfields. And if the pilots want to go flying and they want to check that area, because most of them know it's there apparently, although some 200 or 300 of them have been busted since about 2001, 9/11, for flying into that zone, what we will call, for the sake of expediency here, Class D airspace, you can only fly into it if you have a transponder and you have a flight plan. That's at any time. If it suddenly goes restricted, the same as that 6 mile circuit around the ranch, then you can't fly in there at all, period. That's it. So they've got a wide circle of protection around the president's home, and understandably so. This can extend up to around 8,000 feet on a normal day and go right up to pretty much the limits of space, I suppose, when it's prohibited flight area to all but those that have been given permission to fly in there. Now, just for example, Steve told me he knows where the exact edge of that restricted zone is, or the odor restricted zone, the Class D airspace is, because it's right over his old childhood home. So now we have what appear to be monstrous objects not only coming out of that area, because it's only 18 miles from the perimeter, the odor limit, to over to the center of Stephenville. That's just a blink of an eye, you know, for an aircraft like a jet. You're only talking a minute or so here covering that time from the zone over to Stephenville. Would you not expect then, if there were reports coming in or if somehow they were able to pick up anomalies on radar, that they would not react to it? And they would put up 10 F-16s and try to intercept this thing or protect the area or do a sweep through the area and encourage anything that is in there to get out of there, that it, because it's in restricted airspace, they don't have a transponder going and they don't have a flight plan. From what we know about UFOs, they don't normally bother with that sort of thing.
Often they don't show up on radar.
Yes.
And in Frank Fascino's book, Shoot Them Down, there were a lot of U.S. aircraft that were lost in engagements with UFOs.
Right.
So you would scramble 10 F-16s just in case.
Yeah, this is it. That's the reason I think there was 10, if not more. I would be surprised if there wasn't a couple of dozen of these things up sweeping around, in around, and behind in the area where you wouldn't see them anyway,
mm-hmm.
or coming up from the south. There's something like 7 or 8 or 9 Air Force bases in Texas. It's phenomenal. They're all over the place down there. Actually, when I counted them up, there was something like military complexes down there that were either Air Force bases or Navy. I don't know why Navy in Texas, but there you go. And,
well,
and Army operations.
Yeah, Galveston, yeah.
There was about something like 18 of them. There's mm-hmm. more bases in Texas than there are in Canada.
Well, Texas is bigger than Canada.
Well, according to Texas, anyway. Now we've got this flap going on. First of all, they say there was no jets up that night, but you've got a pilot that says he saw 2 F-16s. Now, he'd know what an F-16 looked like and would probably know what it sounded like. For years, I was able to identify, and I still can, certain aircraft, particularly when they were flying over my house when I was a kid, just by the sound of their engines coming. And you can tell the sound of a jet when it's coming, too, if you're familiar with them. And if F-16s are flying around that area all the time, which they are, then you would tend to know what they sounded like. But he probably had an eyeball on them, could just tell by the shape of the thing as it's going across the sky, and they were in afterburners with a single afterburner. They only have one jet in that thing, that it was an F-16. Their official explanation was that they had 10 aircraft operating in the MOA just south of Stephenville. They run a little fast and loose with the perimeter of the military operational area where they do exercises down there, saying that it comes in over Erath County, E-R-A-T-H County, but it doesn't. It doesn't even come up to Selden, Texas, which is slightly south of that, or east southeast of it. It does come into the county, but it ends about a good 10 miles south of Stephenville. Military operations going on inside of the MOA there are not going to be seen unless you're standing up on a tall building and looking down towards the MOA and see aircraft flying around down there.
Mm-hmm.
The MOA is only about 70 miles by about 35 to 40 miles wide. It's sort of it's not perfectly rectangular. And there's actually two MOAs stuck together there, one part on the bottom. That's an awful small military operational area to have 10 F-16s flying around at 500 to 600 knots, tearing around there doing exercises.
Yeah, and dropping flares.
They didn't say that, but Magahe, or whatever his name is, he thought they might have been dropping flares. Well, they don't drop flares out of F-16s. They're not a flare-dropping aircraft. They have flares on board, but they're a different type of flare used to
distract missiles.
Exactly. The things shoot out of the side of the thing, and they go squirreling off all over the sky to try to encourage the missile to chase it rather than the burner on the back end of the jet. They don't have parachutes or anything on them. They don't drift around, you know, nice and serene with a nice smoke trail and a smear trail off of it. But the funny part of it is McGahey comes up with this idea on Larry King or says that he has information that there was 10 F-16s flying around in the area. And then, sure enough, about 4 or 5 days later, the American Air Force comes out, Major Lewis, and says that we had 10 aircraft flying around in that area, you know, F-16s. Now, we changed our mind, or, yeah, I'm sorry, we forgot about them, you know. Well, you know, everybody would. What's 10 F-16s flying around?
Well, maybe it proves that they watch Larry King live.
So where did McGaha get this information from?
Exactly.
Somebody feed him that, I wonder? I have to wonder about some of these people who are debunkers. If they're not there at the behest of certain agencies so they can go out there and spread confusion when you're trying to nail some of this stuff down, and they're just adding to the noise rather than to the signal. But anyway, now we have F-16s chasing something toward the restricted area.
Going toward the Bush Ranch.
Going towards the Bush Ranch in afterburners, and possibly, and I suspect this is the case because the other two pilots down at HICO told Steve Allen that they heard the sound barrier being broken. And I've heard the sound barrier being broken maybe two times when I was up close and personal, and just about every Saturday morning when I was up at the flying club that my wife and I frequented for 20 years, or just about every weekend during the summer. The Concorde went down the coast going towards New York City. It was offshore, and it was, as it was going by, you could hear it. Boom, 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 boom. But it's way offshore, so that's not a real problem. It's up at, somewhere's up around 62,000 feet, it used to usually fly at. The real up-close-and-personal ones, you're not going to mistake that for an afterburner kicking in. I'll tell you right now, the pressure wave in your ear is really intense.
Yeah.
And I experienced one at years ago at an air show before it became illegal to do so.
Yeah, well, it would break windows.
Oh, yeah, you could shatter windows. There was one in Toronto there where they were building the Avro. So they were testing an aircraft, and he happened to slide by the sound barrier because he was coming down out of a loop, and he went supersonic going down, and he took out just about every window along that line of flight. Not to mention a couple of eardrums probably, but all the windows shattered on the way by as he went by. Well, there was a big noise and complaints and everything went on there for shattering glass. I have written an article on that that's going in Fate magazine. Apparently it's going to be in the March issue. So,
oh, good. Yeah. I look forward to that. Don Ledger writing on Stephenville in Fate magazine. Despite the fact that you've done a lot of technical looking into it and you talked to Steve Allen, presumably you formed an opinion about what actually transpired down there, and with limited access to the information that MUFON has gathered, as with all of us, they're going to put a report together, which maybe will come out in March. What are your conclusions as to what happened down there?
Well, you know, a knee-jerk conclusion on my part right now is that there was indeed some huge anomaly in the sky that night, or barring that, some kind of formation flying going on for some reason by, again, the anomalies. These weren't airplanes or anything like that. Let's face it, because there's exercises going on all the time down there. So the people are used to that. And all of a sudden, they all go snaky for some reason because they have F-16s and start calling newspapers, radios, and the authorities to report UFOs. Mm-hmm. I always find this to be such a silly explanation for what's going on. Unidentified flying objects, in the true sense of the word, doesn't mean alien spacecraft, but possibly these were. Who knows? I'm pretty sure that the United States isn't far enough along to come up with anything in that nature to explain these things. And if they did have them in that nature, what the heck are they doing flying them over Bush's Ranch and down around Stephenville, Texas? Got something secret. You don't show it off over New York City or Stephenville, Texas, even. You keep it secret. They did with the B-2B and the F-117A for years. They were able to keep it secret.
So what you have is anomalous objects in the air. Some people said as large as a football field. Others said it was, hey, it was as big as Walmart.
Yeah.
So then you have those things. And some of the reports remind me of what was seen before the A-10s dropping flares for whatever reason over Phoenix, Arizona, the big boomerang-shaped objects
were
seen down there. Some of the reports at Stephenville are very similar.
Yeah.
And then you have a mad panic going on with the Air Force and a huge security scare because of the restricted area over the Bush Ranch.
Which is, I think, exactly what it was all about. They had reports. I imagine some of these were leaking through to the Air Force, maybe out of Dallas-Fort Worth. It says an Air Guard, the 301st Airborne, where Major Lewis was reporting from, is right in Dallas, right? There's a naval air station there, too. Brad Sparks mentioned that pretty much along the latitude 34-degree line, which cuts right through the very top of the restricted air zone at the Bush Ranch and just below Dallas-Fort Worth, just above Stephenville. Along that line, NORAD, Space Command, has a radar net going along there. One of them is a directional radar, which points in one direction, but there's a string of different radar along there that fan up and read out into space. If anything goes through it, they see it. So essentially, it's a fence. It's a perimeter that anything flies through it, they get it. So if these things flew through that and there was any reflection at all, sometimes they seem to be invisible to radar, and other times they get picked up on radar. I've checked on different cases of my own here where I've checked with air traffic control, and the first knee-jerk response is, no, there's nothing on radar. We didn't have anything. What they're saying is there was no transponder returns or anything like that. Well, Jesus, these things don't have transponders. They don't apply, you know, to buy one, you know, have it set up to their local aviation shop or their little UFO and stick it in there. You know, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
We do that in our own airplanes, and the airliners and the military do. But the thing of it is, what air traffic controllers see nowadays is not the raw data coming through that they used to see years ago. They see a computer-generated representation of what's coming through with the transponder returns on there, whether they be the simple transponder return or the mode C, mode M transponder returns that say exactly what altitude the aircraft is at, what the registration is or the flight number is of that particular aircraft, and they don't see that. On primary radar, what they call a skin paint, it'll show up in primary as a blip, right? And if it's not identified, and it's moving fairly slowly, as a matter of fact, then it probably will be interpreted by the computer that takes this data from the primary pickup and puts it up on that air traffic controller screen. It will have what's called a chicken's foot, or an inverted Y over top of it, which means an unknown. Usually they attribute these slow ones to probably being traffic on the highway, a big semi going by, an aluminum box on it, or a ship out in the ocean or something like that. And it's a reflection. Or it could be a water tower that they already know of and they ignore it. But quite often they get ignored because it doesn't have a transponder code on. For instance, the event that happened off the coast in Nova Scotia here, I'm back on December the 21st last year, where the Puma helicopter was coming back in from the oil rigs. This takes the personnel back and forth. That was at night, and just after, about an hour and a half after dark, they reported a UFO there. When they landed, the co-pilot of that Puma reported it to Flight Service in Halifax, not the tower. The original information I got that it was Halifax Tower had gotten it, so when I called, they didn't know anything about it. They didn't have it in their log, and I said, what's going on here, you know? When I finally interviewed the pilot and the co-pilot, they told me that the co-pilot had reported it to Flight Service. Flight Service then contacted NORAD. NORAD came back and said, oh, yeah, we have that helicopter on the tape, and we also have the unidentified on there, too, with Latin longs.
Oh, that they actually came out and admitted they had something.
Yeah, right. NORAD said they had it, yeah.
So NORAD must have seen whatever it was that was headed over the restricted area at the Bush
Ranch. I don't think NORAD plays the same games, essentially. Maybe they do. I don't know. But it's been my experience that whenever NORAD does get involved, they seem to be puzzled by these things as well, and they don't seem to cover it. For instance, there was an object that came up across from Florida, went up through Chicago and in into Canada some years ago. I don't know if you remember it or not. And it was reported by pilots. You know, I just happened to show up in one of my sweeps through where Transport Canada's UFO database, what they do have, you know, it's normally just aircraft pilot reports of anomalous stuff and so on and so forth, and some of them are pretty interesting. This was different. This was NORAD asking for information from pilots or air traffic controllers about an object they had traversing through high airspace. Nobody knew what it was. And NORAD knows what's up there. NORAD can track a piece of a slipper coming off the front of the Columbia before it came in and tore itself to pieces. They could track that when it drifted off of 3 days or 4 days before reentry. They can track that. They can track a screwdriver drifting around or a few little nuts and bolts. They can track a huge object going across.
And they call those fast walkers. They have a specific name for them. They're unidentified.
Oh, yeah. But NORAD doesn't seem to trouble him to say that, but the Air Force and the rest of them just clam right up. But what happened down here, I suspect that these things triggered that fence down there, and they scrambled jets out of probably Dulles Air Force Base or maybe even out of Dallas, but nobody knows for sure where they would have come from, to intercept. That's their job. Now they had something in their sights that they didn't know what the heck they were. They're chasing. They can't catch them. And it's going right back in over the restricted airspace. And the matter would end there. You're not going to find that out from the Air Force that they couldn't protect Bush's airspace. He wasn't there, by the way. So I have no doubt that something truly anomalous happened down there that night. I interviewed Steve a couple of times now, and I will probably interview again later because it sort of tweaks my interest because of this interrelationship between F-16s being scrambled, plus the fact that there were anomalies up that night, and a lot of people reported them. These aren't crazy people. They're just people trying to, they're just asking questions, you know. What did we see that night? And they're independent, too. They didn't all of a sudden get together and somebody said, hey, did you see that thing outside tonight? And then they run outside and see something.
Yes.
You know, these are people that from different areas all of a sudden saw this happening.
200 independent witnesses.
Yes, exactly. And there's probably more than that.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Because most times witnesses don't report.
Well, that's what MUFON found when they went into one of the smaller places down there and asked all the witnesses who'd seen what had happened on the night of 8th-9th to come in and talk to the investigators there. And what they ended up having was the 200 witnesses to the Stephenville thing and then a whole bunch of other witnesses who had seen other anomalous things over the years but were really concerned about the giggle factor and being labeled as crazy and hadn't reported them when they had had the original sightings. So there's a massive number of sightings that have happened in that area over the years.
Well, the giggle factor is a very important thing. Whoever started the disinformation and the ridicule campaign, whether it was a Robson panel or not, back for the CIA or somebody, or even our own people up here, back in the 50s, it's been effective. It's worked for pilots.
The ones
that really are more concerned about that than anybody else because their jobs might hang in the balance. An example of that is that Channel Island sighting with Gray Boyers there. Now, he reported it.
Commercial airline pilot.
JetBlue, that's who it was. He called in as wondering if there was another aircraft in his vicinity at the such and such distance and so on. And of course, it was the same one that Ray was born, reporting from the opposite side. So that was between the two of them. But this guy won't go on record. He won't take interviews or anything like that because he's from the States. So you have that. And I know it happens here in Canada. And I've become increasingly concerned about the number of balloon sightings that I see reported by Canadian pilots flying Canadian airliners.
Is balloon a code word for UFO?
I think that's exactly what it is. It serves a purpose. The pilot sees something out there that concerns him. He doesn't want to report a UFO, so he reports seeing a balloon. What this does, not only does it get it on the record that there's something there, but he's concerned about other aircraft traveling through that same sector and encountering this thing maybe at a much closer distance than what he is. Or, you know, it could be a hazard to navigation. So it serves a purpose. Everybody blows off balloons. Oh, it was a balloon. Okay, probably that was the explanation. All right, who was that launched by? And where's the tracking information on that? If it's a weather balloon, it's tracked. If it's a scientific balloon, it's tracked on radar. They got beepers on them so they can find them when the package drops. And weather balloons now is starting to get pretty thin because they're not launching as many weather balloons as they used to. They don't launch them around major airports anymore. They use laser ceilometers to check the altitude of the cloud layers above the airport. In the case of the Chicago O'Hare sighting, you know, that was one possibility floated. Well, it's not a possibility whatsoever. There were no balloons launched there because they don't launch balloons at O'Hare. That place is like a beehive. The same with Newark and Washington and Phoenix. Phoenix, incidentally, is, I think, the 8th busiest airport in the United States. These places are intensely busy. You don't go launching stuff up into that, you know, that intake, you know, or bounce off his windshield, and don't forget these are all carrying a little package. If the little package only weighs a pound and you hit it doing 600 miles an hour, it's like a cannon shell going through you. And so these things have to be eliminated almost first blush. Now, I have no doubt if you got some kind of a scientific balloon floating around up there at 100,000 feet and moving along very slowly with the sun bouncing off it, that's going to be NOTAM number one, so pilots know it's up there. And they do drop their package eventually, but it could cause some UFO sightings. They're very bright because the mylar on them is, by its nature, very reflective to sunlight. If it's up there, they know where it is because they're tracking it. It's got radar reflectors on it, and it's emitting beep that can be tracked. And let me just, with this final caveat, I do not in any way, shape, or form think that these things were there because they were trying to contact Bush. All right? They just blundered in the area. I don't think they probably even know he's there. All right? They don't care about our airspace or whatever.
It wasn't the precursor to landing on the White House lawn.
I'm sure that if any such thing was going to happen, it would be a little bit more intricate than that. I think these things were going from or going to wherever they wanted to go from and to, and just did exactly what they pleased and blundered through airspace that they, well, most airspace they're not supposed to be in, but in this particular case, it was like poking a hornet's nest, you know. And there's probably a little more detail in the fake magazine. Can I also mention, Errol, and for some that might not know now, that my first book, Maritime UFO Files, has been reissued. It can be ordered through Nimbus and so on.
Really?
Because, you know, normally whenever I do a radio show or your show and you'd mention those, and I'd say, well, you know, Maritime UFO Files is no longer in print. Mm-hmm. It turned out some 8 radio shows, including yours, during that period between May and the end of last year, it was out, and I didn't even know it. I didn't know it until a royalty check showed up. You know, that's publisher for you. Anyway, it's out there and available again.
That's presumably available at the usual places like Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Maritime UFO Files. It's out there, and it's also available through Nimbus. If you go to my website, www.nonledger.com, you'll see it right on there and the information of where you can contact, including borders and all the rest.
You have been a busy man then.
Well, yeah. Keeps me going. I sort of got off of the Stephenville thing because I had to go down to the States there for half a week or so. And
yeah, you were down at the New Jersey conference.
Yeah, dropped in there to see what was going on and made a presentation.
Maritime UFO Files, available from donledger.com. Don is a pilot, in case you haven't gathered that. And he's the Canadian representative for NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center on Aerial Phenomena. Don Ledger, thank you, sir.
And thank you.
And let's wait and see what MUFON comes up with about Stephenville.
Looking forward to it myself.
Next time, Don.
All right, good talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Almost every other program, we head down to Enterprise in Alabama. Alfred Lemberg lives down there. Alfred has had a chance to listen to various contributors to this program, and we go down to Enterprise and hear Alfred's thoughts on what he has heard on podcast number 454. How about that Stephenville thing, Alfred Lemberg?
Well, it did seem to permeate the program to a degree, I would have to say. You know, we're calling it the Stephenville kerfluffle. It's a very interesting thing, given that it seems to be a flap of many concurrent flaps, and a person is reminded just how often a good spark from a ufological flint is struck before a fire is actually achieved. Talking about some pretty significant things here with regard to people getting fired from their jobs, that's a pretty significant point to touch on. You know, other folks have been fired from their jobs for an interest in UFOs. Myself, you know, I kind of have a committed perspective to what she probably had to go through, even given, I imagine, journalism is a pretty, you work here one place and work someplace else. Sometime else, you know.
And Professor Dom Armentano, most recently fired for his views.
Yes, we're beginning to drop like flies.
Yeah.
It's the increasing frequency of that ufological spark I was talking about, I think, that I think we're going to perhaps see a lot more good people fall on their swords.
Oh, God, I hope not. We can't afford to lose too many more.
Well, it's got to be part of the accelerations, just like everything else. But when you think about the implications and the consequences of these increasing flaps, that there are just an increasing spark that's going to seem to me start a fire here pretty soon. How can it not start a fire?
There are certainly a lot of people paying attention, it would seem.
There's the pressure to shut up or be silent in what's supposed to have been a free society. And all of this stuff is the stuff that Dave Frelott was bringing up, that the Air Force doesn't know where their planes are, which is kind of significant on the one hand, or that they show the inability to stop flying them at all, given the faulty pilot judgment and equipment problems. Who's to know what's going on out there? Mm. But I just think it's significant that the Air Force would report that they didn't have airplanes in the area that hundreds, if not dozens of hundreds, saw and were able to report on, as it turns out. In fact, you didn't Frelott even report over 30 witnesses, and then later on we have reports into three digits, right?
And the numbers keep on growing, apparently. More witnesses are coming forward as we speak.
Yeah, and I think that is an example of a story being squeezed or a story being suppressed where there are just some fires that you can't smother. Some of these fires explode when you try to smother them, and I think we might be seeing an example of that right now.
Yes.
more on Frelat, his noticing that there was kind of a theme echo with this Stephenville thing, similarities with Roswell, kind of in reverse, the lie within the lie, but then the ultimate reversal of that lie, degrading our appreciation for them or officialdom at large because of their lie and their inability to tell a truth. I thought that was kind of interesting that Frelat keyed on that. And then that big reversal. UFOs don't exist, but then what the hell are 10 F-16s chasing?
They're flying over the MOA and over the Bush Ranch for some reason, where they're not supposed to go.
Oddly enough. And interestingly, too, is having 10 F-16s in that area all at the same time. Now, I know that there's a lot of people talking to a lot of other people, and that whole thing was probably orchestrated by an AWACS, for God's sakes. But, man, having 10 F-16s in an area that small indicates their seriousness, because it's a hazardous, unsafe thing to do, to put 10 fast movers in an area that small.
Well, exactly.
That lovely person, Angelia, I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Joyner.
Apparently it's pronounced Angela, but spelt Angelia. And speaking of Angela Joyner, you wrote a tune for her, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. I composed a little ditty, and folks can sure listen to it if they want to.
Well, I will put a link to it, and we'll close this segment with a little piece of it.
Hey, cool enough. And folks, don't let the expectation exceed the event.
So what moved you to write a piece of music for her?
Well, it was that whole thing that she's having to deal with, being kind of the suppressed story and trying to be the torch carrier in this thing, the light bringer in this thing, and she's kind of taken it in the chops for it. And the point where, okay, you know, you won't let me write on the story, I'm going to have to give you my 2 weeks' notice. And they go in there, summary job execution, confiscator computer. Interestingly enough, all the establishment tools necessary for her to continue to pursue the story. But it all works for the best, I think, because she's in a position now where she can follow her own heart and probably get right to the core of it, don't
yes.
you think?
Yes, and she apparently is going to be doing talk radio down there in that area, and also has a website up where she can post whatever the hell she wants.
It's not just happening at Stephenville. It's happening at San Antonio. It's happening in Victoria. It's happening at Corpus Christi. It's happening south of the border. More ufological spark just sailing out of control, for my money.
It has just added fuel to the major fire, the major conflagration that's going on down there.
Yeah. And then is reminding us that here's one more opportunity for that boomerang-style UFO to kind of crop up, and one that's cropped up all over the United States, and even into a town close to me named Elba, had a major kerfuffle with a boomerang UFO, and I've written about it. But the point being is the boomerang shape just keeps cropping up all over the United States.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. For Lot's reminder that the concept of being worried about keeping a black project close, which is to say secret, but then flying these things all lit up so they could be seen. What's up with that?
Yeah, look at us. We're a black project. See all our pretty lights? Oh, there's a really even bigger city. Let's fly over that one.
Right. Oh, man, amazing stuff.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it?
The Magaha, Maguhahi, you know, I mean, nobody is knowing how that...
Magaihai is the way he pronounces it.
Is it Magaihai? I was trying to listen for his pronunciation because everybody around him seems to be getting it wrong, and we never seem to get it right.
Magaha-ha-ha-ha.
More about him later, because he comes up again with Don Ledger, oddly enough. The attitude of Magaihai is his implantation or his inculcation from a mainstream that it would be convenient for us to all go along with. His approach is smirky. It's condescending. It's insulting. It's disrespectful. It's elitist. It's all sorts of adjectives that I could go to the point of getting tedious. And you just wonder why the establishment would have him do it, or this thing that he's doing, and the manner in which he's doing it, and really hurting their cause. And I think that's why Mr. Shermer has taken up the reins and is back to being the default in the seat skeptibunky. Am I right or wrong?
That's the way it was on the last Larry King.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody was probably expecting McGahey to come back. But no, there was Michael Shermer, Kel Surprise.
Well,
obviously, McGahey was an embarrassment. And apparently James Fox had pleaded with the CNN people to get somebody sensible on there.
On the first Larry King Live, if you noticed, look back at that thing when he's asked kind of a pointed question and he's getting pugnacious. He bounces around on the gluteus maximus muscle a little bit like a 9-year-old would. I mean, that's the impression that I got.
Sphincter lock.
Oh, I wasn't even going to go there. The investigators not being allowed to talk to the media as far as the local investigative
group. Oh, you mean
the
Texas MUFON people?
Really, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see the point of that to a degree because they want to get the story right and not dribble and drab stuff out, and I appreciate that. And this comes up, you know, later on with Don Ledger, too, is that they ought to let something go to a degree to help us out and help us through that probably year-long period until the report gets here to kind of let us know what to look forward to. And I'm glad, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, I'm glad Don Ledger was here to do that.
He certainly did fill in really remarkably well.
Yeah, unbelievable stuff,
yes.
Actually. Finishing up with Frelott, his reference to the devils and demons of the Deep South, kind of the attitude that people have down here that all alien investiture and interest is in and of the devil and should be avoided, you know, blah, blah, blah.
UFOs are the devil's spawn.
Yes. I wanted to remind people that if you're listening to this program, we're not talking about you. We're talking to you about that. You understand what I'm saying, folks,
mm-hmm.
The listener? If you're listening to this program, you've already shown the requisite interest.
Uncommon interest, yes.
On the uncommon interest.
They're putting their money where their ears and interest are.
That is a major 10-4.
For which both you and I are truly grateful.
Uh-huh. The whole thing down here with regard to us in the Deep South and being in the Bible Belt and all of that is that we seem to have kind of engendered, you know, every bad moire in the 19th, 20th, and 21st century. We've got a smear there of everything that really is not all that progressive, and move on to our Mr. Woods, who gave a sterling representation and brilliant explication. I was very interested to hear some of the stuff that he was talking about and what he had to say.
That really is a good documentary of David Cherniak's.
And what a title, huh? UFOs and the Politics of Reality. Oh, man, that just does what a title is supposed to do. You know?
Yes, and the documentary follows up splendidly.
I talk myself about my favorite UFO documentary. I mean, let's face it, that thing has changed many times over the years, and it's not every time a new one is produced because they're not doing that. But I remember documentaries like The Phoenix Lights, Lynn Katai, which was very moving on a very visceral level to me, at any rate, and that was my favorite for a while. And then Out of the Blue by James Fox, Rockin' My World, and then boom, up over and on top of that, we have just lately Paul Kimball's Best Evidence. I understand, and from all report, that this new one by David Cherniak is going to once again kind of supplant the list and just be in that panoply of quality films and materials about UFOs. And I'm really looking forward to it.
As well you should, let me tell you that.
If our Mr. Woods was visibly moved, okay, this is that jaded old journalist that's likely seen it all, got the free T-shirt, and wrote the copy for it, I'll bet.
Yes,
you know?
Yes,
and if,
absolutely.
And if a guy like him was moved, this thing has got to really go crazy.
Big time good.
It was interesting that, again, this is reported by Mike Woods, that Cherniak was the individual that brought Hopkins, Jacobs, and Mack together for the first time.
And all the abductees, yes, for the Man Alive series on CBC television years ago.
And I think was first to kind of point out that between those big three who should be having some disqualification and disagreement, I mean, let's face it, and on one level, they're competition for one another, or they were at one time. But no, they weren't. They had this cooperation. They had this synergy that they created when they were together, and Cherniak was able to capture that to a degree, huh?
Absolutely. And I'm sure that once the field sees David Cherniak's documentary, UFOs and the politics of reality. There will be several researchers who didn't want to participate who will be extremely disappointed that they didn't.
When you think about it, everything that guy has done is going to be in the history. It would seem that people would swallow their conviction to do the more correct thing. I was interested to hear that Mike Woods was able to report about Cherniak's documentary that it was a clear and insightful thing, that it was laid out cleanly and simply, and that, and wait for it, even a politician will be able to understand it.
It was a funny line, wasn't it?
Oh, man, it was great. I was rolling on the floor over here. And he indicated that the graphics aren't going to intrude on this thing and that they were tasty, I believe was the quote. Huh?
Yes, that was my expression. They are very, very tasty. Mm-hmm. They look real. And the accuracy on the various aircraft that are illustrated is superb. I haven't seen computer graphics in a UFO documentary that come anywhere near the quality in David Cherniak's documentary.
Well, hoo-ha.
And there will be many people, once they see it, who will be hoo-haing all over the place.
I hope to be one of them.
You will be.
I like to hear a report, too, that an appropriate humor was directed at the skeptics of this ufological thing.
Very nicely done.
And I'm enlivened that there is enough additional material to make a huge box set of this stuff that just set the tone for probably the next 100 years in UFOs.
There have been many people who have attempted to put together a history of UFOs, and some of them have done quite well, but it still isn't out there. And I think that what will transpire out of David Cherniak's project is that, in fact, hey, here is a history of UFOs, because he talked to, with the exception of one or two, all the major movers and shakers in ufology.
I bet you that's just going to be dazzling to behold.
Yeah, mark my words, Alfred, David Cherniak's documentary, along with the additional discs that will be made available as a box set, will contain a history of UFOs that will be unsurpassed for a very long time.
Tell you what, with regard to sneering and snooting at a concept like the Mars Man, that strange rock formation that they saw on Mars,
mm-hmm.
you can laugh and giggle all you want about stuff like that, but what have the authorities been airbrushing out of the photos that they released to the public? There is so much evidence of cut and pasting and airbrushing and photoshopping those things that there's a lot more to giggle at than the Mars Man, you know, so don't insult our intelligence.
Yes, and there's a guy over in Holland has sent me several links to images that very same image that the Mars Man sits in, where there are other bits and pieces there that he sees. I looked at the images and I thought, no, I don't see it. It's much like a Rorschach test. Tell me what you see.
So great work with Mike Woods, and it was great listening to him this time. He's always a joy and a pleasure to listen to. But moving on to Don Ledger now. Don Ledger, again, involved with the Stephenville kerfluffle. But see, we're talking about the Stephenville kerfluffle examined and amplified and blown up to coffee table size and all the juicy bits and details. And Don Ledger has pretty much provided them all in this broadcast. It was great to listen to. I was astonished to be reminded, once again, because I remember this coming up, that Don Ledger was actually the one to break the Busch Ranch tie-in.
Actually, it was Joel Carpenter, who's with MUFON out there in Washington State, who had privately emailed Don and said, hey, have you seen these maps of the no-go zones in the Stephenville area?
Oh, okay. Our thanks to him. But great that Ledger was able to take the lateral and get the ball to the touchdown.
Right. And Joel Carpenter also is a pilot, which was why he was intrigued by what he found on those no-fly zones and the MOA areas around Stephenville in Texas.
Yeah, a mile long, half mile high, lights all over it, traveling 3,000 miles an hour completely silently. Isn't that what we're talking about?
That's
here?
What we're talking about here.
Someone, I believe his name was Lance, actually moved to think that, hey, this just might be the War of the Worlds end of the world. I want to go home and be with my family.
Well, that's one of the reactions people get to seeing things that they can't explain.
I thought it really, interesting to note that the fellow didn't want to panic and head for the hills and grab the guns and the station wagon and a couple of six packs of beer and, you know, head on up for some riotous merriment.
Well, you know that flares aren't going to cause that kind of reaction in a sensible human being.
I think that's it in a nutshell. But it remains that Lance was one shook-up dude. He was moved.
Moved to run home and be with his family in case it was the end of the world.
Yeah. With regard to those 10 jets in the Stephenville area flying on afterburners, I think we can lay this at Don Ledger's doorstep. He's the first to remind us that when you have jets on afterburners and sonic booms reported, that's just something that's not allowed in day-to-day activity. It's against the law. It's just that kind of thing that was an indicator that something indeed was being chased. UFOs don't exist, but we were chasing something unidentified and flying.
And it must have shown up on the radar because they scrambled jets. And as you said, you get 10 planes in the air like that. Somebody has to be controlling them, and there must have been at least an 11th larger aircraft, the AWACS aircraft, controlling those F-16s.
That's kind of the thing about prohibited airspace, is what we used to call it. Airspace rules have changed moderately, and the way it's constructed in three-dimensional air is a little peculiar and different than it was for me 12 years ago. But the point being is that those prohibited areas are serious business. Areas around Congress, around the White House, select points and spots get prohibited status for one reason or another, and one of these is the president's ranch. But he has a huge area of airspace around that environ protected by the Secret Service, and I would say probably shoulder-launched air-to-air missiles.
More than likely. They're a Marine marksman.
Yep.
They're ready to down anything that comes over there.
But the point being, prohibited airspace is prohibited. You can go to jail. It's covered by all sorts of rules and executive orders. And I'll tell you, big trouble happening, big trouble happening. So what are monstrous objects doing coming out of that area? As far as the approaching 10 F-16 jets on afterburners creating sonic booms to get to them, you know, what's up with that? what are we not chasing here?
Dropping flares. Yeah. As Don pointed out, F-16s don't carry the kinds of flares that would hang in the sky.
Just self-defense flares. Heat sources to draw away...
From the afterburner.
Right. Don mentioned that there were just a whole mess of military bases in Texas, and Texas has a pretty long military history. A lot of military pork goes to Texas for congressmen and senators and what have you, and that's kind of the indicator there that explains all those bases. But again, with all those bases and all those little population centers, why would you want to fly something secret that we own, all lit up like a Christmas tree, and then have it scoot to the horizon at 3,000 miles an hour? Come on, please, somebody help me here.
How many times have we asked that question over the years?
And we will continue to ask it. That is our pledge to you, dear listener. Here's something interesting, too, with regard to Mr. McGahey. How is it that he is the one to break the story that F-16s are in the area when the Air Force has already indicated that they were flying nothing? How does he get that 4 days prior and then it turn out to be the truth? That sounds to me an awful lot like one hand washing the other.
Which raises, as has been raised very recently, in whose employ is McGahey?
Employs a retired military jet pilot, so we have no respect for him at all. And I only say that, folks, because I'm a rotary wing aviator, and that's a real pilot.
Mr. Helicopter Lemberg. That's chopper dude.
The copter doctor, yeah.
Why is it that McGahey's credentials as a former Air Force pilot and an amateur astronomer, which never gets stressed when they put a credit up, an amateur astronomer gets to be a skeptic and whose word is accepted so casually by some of the media.
Whereas a real astronomer that has seen a UFO like Clyde Tombaugh can't get in the door edgewise.
Right. Exactly.
I'd mentioned earlier that we're going to have to wait a long time for this Stephenville report down there, and it'd be well worth it, and I hope they can dribble and drab something out to us.
Supposedly in March.
What, that they'll have it in March?
March was what Ken Cherry told me would be when the report was released.
It just O'Hare took so long, and I just naturally assumed that that kind of time would be going too. But maybe this is all part of the acceleration. We'll get it in March.
There's a lot of stuff to put together, as Ken told me. He's the director of MUFON Texas, and I had tried to persuade him to come on this program and just fill us in a little bit, and he was really reluctant. He was burned out. He'd done so much media. His business was suffering. When I suggested to him that perhaps I could talk to either Terry Groff, who was one of the investigators, or Stephen Miles Lewis, Smiles Lewis, Ken Cherry told me that MUFON members were forbidden to talk to anybody until the report came out in March. So there we have it.
And I can appreciate that on one level, and I can be disappointed with it on another. But my disappointment is more than covered by the legendary Don Ledger, who has taken the time now and is able to provide us with some kind of brilliant trailer. And just a reminder that Don Ledger is just somebody that speaks from a real sobriety and a sincerity and a select intelligence and the calmest rationality. And the man is just a prince. I know I've said that before, and I will likely say it again. But, you know, when you hear a report from Don, take it to the bank. Do not pass go. And he indicated it's kind of knee-jerk, and then he goes into the explication, and you find out that, no, he's a calm, you know, reasonable, reasoned out, good report, the upshot of which is that there are bona fide UFOs. Duh. There are hundreds of credible witnesses, that there's a cop video, that there are other pictures attendant, that there's Air Force involvement in their lie and recovery and all of their unusual behavior. Something happened. His pointing out that radar returns are ignored if they don't squawk a code by radar operators. I had to be reminded of that. You know, it kind of surprised me originally because you think, well, radar, looking at something, you get a return, you ought to be worried about it. But, you know, like, things get so busy out there that if they are not squawking little codes that can be read on the radar screen, you know, they're thinking, oh, that's just something out there that's an anomaly. We don't worry about it because they got other things to do, other fish to fry, to a point. Radar returns being ignored like that, and the admission by those same radar operators that those things that they're not really looking at are out there, which is kind of interesting. But the killer was NORAD admitting to unknown radar returns and trying to solicit help from people around them in the area about what these things must be. So at any rate, I'm done.
And very nicely done too, Alfred. Did you manage to go and look at the trailer for the new Indiana Jones movie?
I couldn't get it to work for me.
That's probably because the site was being hit so hard. Paramount Films website, the new Indiana Jones movie, somebody had posted to the Project 1947 email list that there were a few interesting frames in that trailer. So I went and took a look, and I don't know whether you recall, Alfred, but over the years I have, with several guests, joked that the Roswell wreckage probably ended up in the same warehouse that the Ark of the Covenant did at the end of Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant movie.
I do indeed remember you making that aside.
Well, the trailer now has a small sequence where there's a bit of a confrontation between people and a pair of glasses gets knocked off. And the camera follows the glasses down and they land on a crate that says Roswell NM 1947. I guess that silver thread that connects our thoughts connected to someone over at Spielberg's production company who thought it would be highly amusing to put that in there.
A strange synchronicity.
Strange days.
Indeed.
And I guess that brings us nicely to the end of this program. Oh, listen, I hear your tune for Angela Joyner down there in Stephenville, Texas.
Try to enjoy, folks.
Thank you, Alfred.
Hasta la vista.
We shall talk to you soon. that wraps up Strange Days Indeed number 454. In our next edition, we'll catch up with Ted Phillips. He of the Physical Trace Evidence Research Organization, CPTR. And he has a lot of interesting things to update us on. Also with us, of course, Dave Frelott and Stuart Miller. My thanks to Dave Frelott, to Mike Woods, to David Cherniak, to our East Coast correspondent, Don Ledger, and, of course, Alfred Lemberg. And thank you for supporting Strange Days Indeed. Bye. From Mars. If you just stop and think, you'd realize just what it means. They're more than atom bombs or falling stars. And though the war may be true, that's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again